at the end of the book of Hebrews, which is where we've been, we hear the author of Hebrews. We don't know who wrote it, but we hear the author, whoever he or she was, they say that Jesus, for the joy that was set before him, endures the cross. And that what we find in that statement is the joy of Jesus, the joy that was set before him, which, by the way, is you. That's what the author's speaking of. The joy that was set before Jesus, you, he endures the suffering of the cross, which, as we discover, is his purpose. And so in the Christian life, I want to contend that we don't experience one of these three, joy, purpose, or suffering, without having been touched by the other two. And if we'll realize this, I'm also convinced that we can actually have some real spiritual health that grounds us when life sort of pulls out from under us and we become disoriented. And so what we're going to do this morning is we're going to talk about supreme joy. And every morning before you guys get here, the staff, the volunteers, we get together and pray. And I told the staff, and I just be honest with you for a second. I told the staff, like, of these three, the purpose, suffering, and joy, this is the one that I feel most inadequate at preaching. Like, there's actually something inside of me that even feels deeply hypocritical about it. Because of these three, purpose, joy, and suffering, it's the one that I feel like I experience the least, therefore, like, know least about spiritually. But I'm also willing to bet that I'm not alone in that. Because the author today is going to say that there's this, the author's going to use this word assembly of joy. We're going to read it. But the actual literal translation, your translators were polite. When the author says there's this assembly of joy that's around Jesus, he's actually, like, the author's referring to, most of the times that Greek word gets used, it's like a wild party. Where people, after they've had a few drinks, like, get really excited. Like, there's this exuberant energy. That's the word that the author uses. It's this powerful joy that sustains us through anything. And if I could just be honest with you for just a second as we start this series. One, to just sort of confess some of my hypocrisy and actually getting up here and pretending like I'm the expert on it. But there is this deep sense of inadequacy that I feel. But I'm willing to bet there's a lot of us that when Jesus talks about this unchangeable, this immutable, this unstealable joy, many of us go, I don't know if I've ever had that kind of joy. Like, I don't know what does that joy kind of look like for me. I'm also aware that for those of us who have found ourselves in seasons of suffering or of darkness, when I talk about supreme joy and God wants joy for you, this can feel like a slap in the face. Or they can feel like, if God wants joy for me, then he would have never have allowed this to pass through his hands into my life. And so I want to just offer, if that's you this morning, a little bit of comfort, a little bit of hope. So the author of Hebrews is writing, we know this at least, is writing to a group of people that have sort of found themselves on the wrong end of life. They found themselves discouraged and disheartened. So the author is writing to a group of people that have sort of been taking life on the chin. Life has come at them on their own terms. And so the author is writing to a group of people that are extremely discouraged. They're disillusioned. They're disoriented. And so what we're going to do this morning before I read the text is I want to propose to you two things. The author is going to propose there are two things to consider. Okay, two things. One is, there is this unstable happiness, this unstable joy, which leads to agony. Okay, this will be the first paragraph we read. The author's going to say, there's this happiness, but it's unstable. And it leads to agony, and it leads to fear. And underneath this agony and this fear, the author's going to say, are these commands, these demanding commands. There's these commands that add weight to our souls, that make our happiness unstable, and that always result somewhere down the line in agony and in fear. The author's going to say, even Moses encountered this and like felt undone with this kind of unstable joy. Okay, this is going to be the first paragraph I read, but then there's going to be a second paragraph. But the author's going to say there's also some unshakable freedom. There is something offered to you in Christ that cannot be stolen, robbed, taken away, disillusioned, or pushed out. It is immutable, it is unchangeable, it is unalterable. There's a freedom here, the author's going to say, that leads to, and I picked this word carefully this morning, it leads to powerful joy. Powerful joy. The kind of joy that sustains you, that changes you, that does something to your soul, that shapes you in the kind of way that when you encounter suffering, when life is disillusioning, it anchors you. It holds you fast. It's a kind of joy that's not just like, I'm happy now. It's a kind of joy that changes you as a person. Okay, so these two roads the author's going to describe. One is there's this unstable happiness that comes from these commands or these demands on that are placed on the soul that lead always, like the road down there is agony and fear. But also in Jesus, there's this unshakable freedom, unalterable freedom that leads to powerful joy. And what I want to do this morning is I want us to ask, like, what is that powerful joy? What does that look like? What would it look like if I asked God to show me what that is? This is what I need. This is what I want for us. The kind of joy that changes your life. So let me read the text for us, and then we'll get started. This is Hebrews chapter 12, starting in verse 18. For you have not come to the mountain that can be touched, and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no farther word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. Even if an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I'm trembling with fear. But you have said, come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. There's that word. To the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to the God, the judge of all, the spirits of righteousness made perfect. To Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant that is sprinkled blood that speaks better word than the blood of Abel. See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when he refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven? At that time, his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised once more, I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words, once more, indicate the removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, the author's gonna compare and contrast two sort of outcomes, two scenarios. One is there's this unstable, right? So you notice the author uses the word shakable. There's this shakable experience that has these unbearable commands that are placed on the human soul, on the human heart, we're going to talk about this, that lead to agony, that lead to gloom, the author uses, that leads to fear. Even Moses says, I'm trembling with fear. But there's also an assembly of joy. This is powerful joy and this freedom in Jesus. And so I want to talk first about the first thing the author introduces us to, which is this unstable reality. The author uses this words of shaking, right? It's unshakable, and there's an unshakable reality in God, and there is a shakable reality. Okay, so what is the author really saying here? So I want us to ask that question. By looking at verses 18 and verses 22, the author says, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire. And in verse 22, the author says, but you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God. Okay, so that word come there, like in English, it sort of implies like a transition, right? I'm coming to you or you're coming to me. It's like geographical. But that's not the Greek word implies something actually much more powerful. It's almost like I have arrived. I have arrived at a situation. Now this is a little bit like, I don't know, in our culture, each one of us have this idea that we've arrived at something. right? When this happens in my life, when this happens to me, like I'm okay. When I have accomplished this, when I have realized this, when I have done this, when I have this relationship, this marriage, this person, whatever it is, we have something deep inside our hearts that we say, when I have this, like I've made it, I'm good. I don't need anything else from life. When I have become this type of person or reached this type of success or have achieved this type of approval, like I'm good as a person. There's something in my soul that will feel content and peaceful if I find this thing. This is the words that the author is using here. Basically, the author is contending, like, what's the thing that drives you in life that when you have it, you go, that's it, I'm good. I've made it. I've proved that I'm worth something. That's what the author is saying. You have not come to this, or you have come to this. What the author is saying is there's a reality that if you try to make yourself feel okay with this, it proves that you end up in an unshakable reality, or there's a reality that can't be stolen from you, can't be taken. It cannot change based on any circumstance. Okay, so let's talk first about this. The author says you have not come. You don't have a reality in your soul that is shakable. An unstable happiness that leads to agony and fear. Okay, so let's talk about this for a little bit. My wife and I, we just finished White Lotus. It's a train wreck of a show. I don't know if I'd recommend it, but it's a train. Like, you look at it and you're like, I can't look away. I have to watch the next episode, as painful as the last one was. They say it's a modern Greek tragedy, right? But in the show, and I'm not going to spoil it for those of you who are watching. I know some of you are watching it. In the show, The White Lotus, in this last season that just came out, there's a character in the show. He's a wealthy businessman. He's successful. And he has what seems to be a very pristine family. He has three beautiful children who also seem successful. He has a beautiful wife. Like, there's this. They show up to White Lotus. It's this hotel, and the show sort of follows the different guests of the hotel. And as we follow this character, they show up to this hotel in Thailand, and the hotel, it's a peaceful, I don't know, yoga kind of, I don't do yoga, I'm really struggling with how to describe it, but like, it's a spiritual kind of retreat, right? So they make everybody give up their phones when they get there. Now, the dad, he doesn't do this, he hides his phone, and as the show goes on, it turns out that this guy, a couple of years back, had made a really shady business deal, did something that was kind of off the books. We don't really know what it was, there's no indication, but his lawyers call him and say, hey, I just want to let you know that the FBI is here and they're waiting for you. When you get stateside, they're cuffing you. Like, they're waiting for you at the airport. And he begins to unravel. Now, none of his other family know this because they don't have their phones. But now he has this vacation with his family where he knows the thing that is going to happen when he gets back is he's going to get arrested and they're going to lose everything. A lawyer calls and says, they've frozen your assets. They're going to take the home, everything. Apparently, one of the other guys that he was in a shady business with made a plea deal. And so, like, he said, they know everything. Not much we can do. And so what the dad begins to do without the family realizing is he begins to ask each of the family, his two sons, his daughter, and his wife, hey, just, and he does it nonchalantly, he's trying to kind of probe, they don't know what he's doing, but he asks them, hey, you know, what would life be like for you if we lost everything? You know, what would you kind of just plays it off, he asks each of them differently, right? And each of his children and his wife give very different answers. Right, his oldest son who works for him says, oh, dad, my entire career and the success of my life is built into your career, and I'm so thankful for that. So thankful I have that. I don't know what I'd be if I didn't have the success. His daughter tells him, I'm so grateful for all that I have, all the comforts and the AC and the air conditioning. Like, she has all this, like, now that I'm in Thailand and I kind of see the contrast in life, like, I'm so grateful for the comfort that I have. And then he kind of probes with his wife, and he asks her, say, hey, what would, you know, I don't know, what do you, you know, we gave all this up, no money, nothing. And she's like, oh, but you have such a beautiful family. You've done such a good job. When people look at you, they see someone to admire. Your children admire you. I admire you. Our friends admire you. And of course, as the show goes on, you begin to see these answers begin to really eat inside of his soul. Because he begins to realize these things that his family has built his identity around, they're going to lose them. the image that his wife loves, the comfort that his daughter loves, the success that his son loves. He has one child that kind of plays it off. It's like, I don't know, I'd be fine, the youngest one. But the other three, it's obvious that so much of who they are is built into to success, to image, to comfort. And so when the author here says, look, there's an unstable happiness, what the author is implying is there's a happiness that we think make us happy. There's things that make us happy, we think make us happy, but when we lose them, they shake us to our core. We get unraveled. We don't know who we are anymore. This is, the writers of the show pick up on this really well, as this family navigates this dynamic. They don't know who they are. They don't know what's happening. He knows what's happening, and you could see the anguish. You actually begin to see the fear. This is what the author of Hebrews is talking about. All the things that built up their identity, that made them feel okay, that made them feel some sense of worth of who they are, they're going to lose it all, and he doesn't know what to do with that. We spent a couple of weeks ago, we looked at a quote by Kathleen Norris. She's an essayist and poet, and she says this, something similarly to, I think, the author of Hebrews is trying to capture. She said, "What would I find in my own heart if the noise of the world were silenced? Who would I be?" Here's what she's asking. If all the things that have formed my identity, that have molded my identity, were just kind of stripped away, who am I? Now, I want to contend that most of us, we struggle to actually ask this question, much less answer this question. The author of Hebrews is challenging us to ask this question this morning. I want to challenge us to ask this question this morning. But what she's asking, what Kathleen Norris is asking, is who would I be if all the things that have formed my identity were gone? Who am I anymore? It's interesting. During the 2007-2008 housing market crash, some of you remember that, especially I was graduating college right at that time, and no one was finding jobs, and it was stressful. And you may not realize this, but there was depending on what study you're looking at, there was an uptick in suicides between 5,000 and 10,000, depending on who's doing the reporting. And one expert on suicide at the time mentioned that as they run a suicide prevention center, and they said as the economy continued collapse, there were two risk factors that they found in people that were a higher risk for suicide. It was a loss of wealth, and it was a loss of the reputation that went along with that. And as those things began to chip away, they said we began to see, this is where we began to find someone was at risk for killing themselves or harming themselves. It's this unstable happiness. Because here's, so what makes it unstable? Is it just that we lose it? No, it's that it actually ends up controlling us. These things end up making demands on our soul. The things that form our identity, these things, we think we're chasing them. We think we're pursuing success. We think we're pursuing healthy marriages, healthy kids, wealth, recognition, whatever it is for you. We think we're pursuing it, but what we actually find is it's pursuing you. This is why the author in verse 20 says it, they create unbearable commands. Isaiah, he's an Old Testament prophet. He has a very similar experience here. So when Isaiah encounters God, Isaiah is an Old Testament prophet. When I say Old Testament prophet, I'm speaking of someone who came before the time of Jesus. And what we know about Isaiah, and some of you probably heard this quote before, is that he was a gifted orator. He was kind of like a who's preacher. Like, he was very gifted at speech. I know none of you at Restore know what a beautifully crafted sermon sounds like, but some people, like, sermons are like, it's an art, right? It's this beautifully crafted oration. That's just who Isaiah was. He was kind of man, he was known as the man of golden lips. But then, I know none of you, please don't, if any of you ever tell me my lips are gold, don't. But then he meets God. And this is what he says. "Woe to me," I cried, "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips." Provides some context now, doesn't it? I always heard this preached. It was like, he probably said like lots of bad words. No, here's what he's saying. The thing that built my identity, even if it was a good thing, I'm a powerful orator. When he comes into the presence of God, he realizes how unstable this is. Even though he's the man of golden lips, what does he say? I'm the man of unclean lips. The thing that I had built my life around, turns out it's nothing. And this is why it's so important for us to understand that the things that control our hearts, they're putting demands on us. Right? Some of us grew up in homes where we were the helper, right? Like our identity is built around helping. It's not a bad thing, by the way, but what happens is as we go through life, if we're not helping somebody, we don't know who we are. And some of us go to great lengths to help, sometimes to the point we get codependent or we get in unhealthy relationships, but we don't know what else to do. And this is when the thing that has built our identity begins to make demands on us, begins to dictate what we do. Right, some of us, it's parenting. Look, I'm a parent. I want to be a good parent. But sometimes it's easy, especially if we grew up in a wounded household where we're like, I don't want to make the same mistakes again. And then we start to see those mistakes forming, which happen, right? We start to see some of the ways that our own woundedness is forming our kids. Right? We're filled with guilt. We're filled with shame. We hide. We don't know what to do. Because even this identity of being a good parent, it's now starting to make demands on your soul. And what you're going to find is those demands end up crushing you. Right? Others, and we've known people like this, relational security is important to them, right? Relational value. If they just have somebody, and there's nothing wrong with relationship. I'm married, right? But we've known, and this may have been us at certain points in our life. Like they start making compromise. They compromise on their values. They end up in abusive relationships. But as long as they have some love, right? They cling to that until all of a sudden this need for love is now in control of them. And they'll do all kinds of things and make all kinds of compromises and stay in all kinds of situations in order to secure that love. And that need for love becomes these unbearable commands that places a weight on their souls. I think this is true even for morality and religion, by the way. I think we can do this in our own faith. All right, so some of us we know we're straight and true, right? We're honest. But sometimes our own need to be moral can actually control us and place these weights on us. I've been a part of churches before where morality was sort of it was the thing that kind of formed the hierarchy in the church. And underneath like who's best behaved right now, is a whole plethora of shame and guilt and secrecy and fear of getting found out. And all of a sudden, our desire to be a good person, which is a good thing, right? We want us to be good people. But all of a sudden, this identity of being a good person starts to control us. And we start having to hide. We start having to put on a mask. We start having to manipulate so that others don't see some of the parts of ourselves we're afraid that they'll see. And just like that, even a desire to become a good person becomes these unbearable commands. Jesus has a very similar conversation with some of his followers. So in Luke 10, he sends out a bunch of his disciples and says, I'm giving you all kinds of power and influence. Go. And they go. And they cast out demons and they heal and they come back to him and they report to him. It's like, we're doing all of these things. We've been casting out demons. We've been healing the blind. Like, we're men of golden lips. Like, we've been powerfully preaching. And look at his response here. He says to this, Luke 10, verse 20, however, do not rejoice that the spirits submit to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Here's what Jesus, look what Jesus is saying. Hey, don't take it for granted. Yes, great that you're casting out demons, that the spirits submit to you. That's what he's saying. But really what's most important is your name is written in the book of life. He's referring to, we'll talk a little bit more about this, about this kind of unshakable joy. All of your religious accomplishments, as impressive as you feel that they are, as impressive as they might actually be, they're insignificant compared to knowing that your name is written in the book of life. All your religiosity, all of your morality, all the power that you think you have is nothing as long as your name is written in the book of life. And so Jesus, in his own way, draws their attention away from even their own like good religiosity and says, yes, it's important, but not as important as you guys think. In fact, it's relatively insignificant to knowing who God is and being written in the book of life. Okay, so this is what the unstable happiness from unbearable commands looks like. And I've shared this before in my own life. I don't have a drive to be successful. I have a drive to be perceived as successful. And in my own life, like that drive to be successful or be perceived successful, which is success is not wrong. But there have been times in my life that it drives me towards secrecy. It drives me towards shame. It drives me to manipulate my image, to manipulate you guys, to what you see and what you don't see about me so that I can appear successful. I remember when we established our internal board, I always had this this fantasy of, you know, like when we had our board and I was like, hey guys, look at how successful I've been. Look at the church I've built. Like here, you know, welcome. Instead of my first board meeting, it was like, look at the mess I've made. Like, welcome. You know, like, and I remember in that moment feeling totally unraveled, totally unmade. The word I used with my wife often was exposed. I feel so exposed. I can't control or manipulate my image in the way that I used to. I spent my whole career doing it. I spent my whole career making sure my colleagues saw me as successful, my clients saw me as successful. And all of a sudden, I find myself in this situation now where I can't do that. I don't know what to do. I don't know who I am. Right? And that was a dark time in my own pastoral career as I wrestled with that. Because the weight of the unbearable commands of being perceived as successful started to dictate all kinds of things in my life. They started to dictate how I felt about myself, whether I was okay or not okay. Whether I found unhealthy ways to cope or not. Was all built on whether or not I could be perceived successful. And then when I lost control of that, I became unraveled. But I want to contend this morning that every single one of us here, when it comes to our own happiness, we have something similar like this. If my kids will just be successful, if my marriage will just be successful, right? If I can just achieve this level of financial security, if I can just get my dad to finally say he's proud of me, if I can get my mom to finally see me, right? If I get this, that's the thing that I'll feel okay. And what the author of Hebrews is saying is it's an unstable happiness. What Jesus says, so what if the powers submit to you? What you want, what's important is that your name is written in the book of life. So what is the book of life? Let's talk now in the time that we have left about this unchangeable freedom which leads to powerful joy. This unchangeable freedom, which leads to powerful joy. So one of the things that we begin to realize, right, as we pursue these things in life, and as we pursue them, we begin to realize when we're healthy that they're actually pursuing us. And so in this book of life, we actually read a little bit about what this book is in Revelation, but we know this. In Revelations 2:17, Jesus said, this is Jesus speaking, by the way, he says, to the one who is victorious, I will give some hidden manna, and I also give to that person a white stone with a new name written on it, only to the one who receives it. Okay, so what is Jesus saying here? What is this book of life? What is this new name? What does Kathleen Norris mean when she says, who am I if all of the demands of the world were stripped away? This unshakable hope that's being offered to you and me in Christ is there is something that Jesus is giving us, an identity that cannot be shaken, that cannot be stolen, that cannot be twisted, that cannot be manipulated. Right, many of us, portions of our identity were formed by harsh things someone said, abuse someone gave. Like, there are ways in which our identity has been formed around our own failures, our own mistakes, our own shame, or what something else or someone else put on us. But what Jesus is offering us is saying, when your name is written in the book of life, there's something about your identity in Jesus as his joy, as the Hebrews author tells us, that cannot be stripped away from anything. It cannot be staked, it cannot be shaken, it cannot be stolen. No suffering can minimize it. No amount of accusation can steal it. And I gotta be completely honest with you. The only reason I'm up here today, the only reason I'm preaching this sermon, the only way I made it in Pastor Olds' ministry has been I learned this. I learned I could be viewed as a failure by everybody else around me, but because I knew that I was something to Jesus, that anchored me. It anchored my soul. And it gave me this kind of powerful joy. And this is where as I said at the beginning of the sermon, I can't say oh yeah, I wake up every morning like this. Most of the time I'm wrestling with the unbearable commands in my life. But the few moments that I've found, like when I'm able to listen to the Spirit and the prompting of God's love and wisdom for me, I know that because I am His, there's a joy in that that cannot be shaken, that cannot be stolen. And so what I want to do this morning is, I know for many of us, you're like, you know, I hear you, but also how do I really know it can't be, how do I really know it can't be stolen? How do I really know it can't be taken from me? Right? Like there's things that have happened in my life that, you know, when I look at them, I'm like, if I could do anything in the world, change anything in the world, I would go back and change that. What do I do with that? How do I find joy in the midst of those kinds of things? How do I truly know that this joy cannot be stolen? This joy of knowing that I belong to God, that I am His beloved, that I'm His joy. How do I know this really can't change? Nothing can change this. Well, this, friends, is what Easter is. So Easter tells us, and we'll use all kinds of language around this over the coming weeks, but Easter tells us that Jesus conquered death, that He has overcome death. Okay, what are we really saying? Here's what we mean when we say Jesus has conquered death or He's overcome death. In the ancient world, as is today, death is the one thing that humans cannot change it. Right? There is nothing you can do in your circumstances to avoid the fact that you will die and your loved ones will. There is nothing you can do to change this. Death is the one thing that has true power over the human heart and soul. All right, I watched an interesting documentary about the guy who invented Venmo. He sold it for, you know, I don't know, it was a couple bill or something. It was a bunch of money, right? And he's in his documentary, he's like, I'm going to live to 150. And he tells us, I spend millions of dollars on my healthcare every year. And he's got, like, it's working. Like, he's got this, like, supplemental plan. But it's a little bit weird because he's, like, 50, but his doctors say he's, like, the skin of a 17-year-old. So he's, like, 55, but has the body of a 17-year-old boy. And, like something looks off, but, like, apparently he's just really healthy. But even him, even with all the resources that he's throwing in there, even all that he has, there's going his goal is still 150. And what you begin to realize is that death is actually the true enemy of the human condition. It's not actually sin, and it's not actually Satan. Look, Satan shows up in Scripture, and at the very beginning, he shows up for actually just a few verses of screen time. That's all he gets, and then he's gone. And this part of your Bible you probably skip because I always skip it. But right after Adam and Eve get cast out of the garden and Cain kills Abel, there's a couple of chapters in Genesis. It's multiple chapters long where it's like, so-and-so lived to 140 years, then they died. So-and-so lived to 130 years, then they died. So-and-so lived to here and here and here. And what you begin to realize is death is the true enemy of the human condition. Death is the thing that has always had power over humans. And so when we see that Jesus has conquered death, what we're saying is the one thing, the things that we feel most defeated by, the things that we feel most control us, can't, because Jesus has overcome them. the things that dictate our existence, the things that we feel enslaved by, these demanding controls that are over our soul, these demanding commands, they don't have the power over our life anymore because Jesus has defeated death. Death is the true enemy. Dan Allender, he's a theologian and counseling psychologist. He works with trauma sexual survivors, but he says this, and this is where we'll close this morning. He says, even when tragedy has nothing to do with physical death, it still involves a form of death that is the shattering of shalom, that is peace or harmony. A divorce is death. Sexual abuse is death. Betrayal in a relationship, the loss of a job, conflict in a marriage, an auto accident, an illness, a loss of meaning or hope or joy are all forms of death. In the Bible, God makes it clear that the rebellion results in death. Death lies at the heart of all tragedy and at the core of every personal narrative. Here's what he's saying. As we encounter death in our life, and for some of us, our loved ones are ripped from us in this way, but there's also other tragedies that we experience that are like deaths. They kill our soul. Right? As this wealthy businessman begins to realize, I'm going to lose everything when I return, you begin to see the agony that he wrestles with. A part of who I thought I was dying, is dead. But what we discover in the hope of Jesus is that he's conquered all that we feel enslaved to. He's conquered all that we feel has controlled us. He's conquered all the shame that binds us. All the death that we experience because our names are being written in the book of life gives us an unalterable hope, an unshakable joy that leads to this powerful experience of knowing who God is and him knowing us and our being his joy. What I want to do as we prepare to take communion this morning, friends, is to invite you to wrestle with this. I know this isn't always easy and it's not always obvious. How do I discover this joy that can't be stolen or shaken? What does this look like for me in my life? And what I want to invite you to ask God to show you the ways that this joy has remained hidden from you, that he might open your eyes and show you his goodness and his love. This is what knowing God is. It's having our names written in a book of life that cannot be changed. It's been given a new name that all of our other identities cannot shift or change. All the other ways that life has chipped away at our souls, all the little ways that life has brought death to our souls. What we celebrate in communion, what we participate in, what we partake in communion, is the goodness of God. It's being written in the book of life. It's being written, his love's writing a new name in our hearts that cannot change and that cannot be stolen from us. So would you come down the center aisle? The servers will say a blessing over you as you do. We also have gluten-free options as well. Would you come and partake in the goodness of God with me this morning?